Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Adam and Eve. The biblical tale is one of the best-known stories in the world. I mean, it's got everything, right? Creation, destruction, good and evil, knowledge and temptation, sin, grace, innocence, and the fall. The tiny little story does contain within it everything, every question, but perhaps not every answer that we ask ourselves about who we are and why we are the way we are. So it's no surprise that Steven Greenblatt is captivated by Adam and Eve. The Pulitzer Prize-winning Harvard literary historian loves to grapple with good beginnings. He did so with Will in the World, How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare, and with modernity itself in The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. Here now comes his latest book. It's called The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve, and Steven Greenblatt joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much, Meghna.
First of all, I mean, your book is all about the story, right? Can you tell us the story about why you wanted to tackle Adam and Eve?
The story of Adam and Eve is probably the most successful short story ever written.
Yeah.
It became the foundation stone for the three great Western monotheisms, for Judaism, for Christianity, and for Islam. That's not bad as a track record, and it has lasted for thousands of years, and it's guided millions of people to trying to understand their fears and their dreams and their sense of shame,
mm-hmm.
To understand just about everything,
yeah.
Why they labor, why women scream in pain when they have babies, what the relationship is between men and women, why we have species dominance, why we're afraid of snakes, why we die.
There's so much, right?
It's a lot in about 50 verses.
That's the thing about it. It's so short but so potent. But, I mean, in your book, you actually mention your own experience, for example, as a child in Temple, right?
I start there, not with the experience of the story of Adam and Eve. I can't remember when I first heard it, but like most of us, I must have heard it when we were very young. But just with my experience of a story that had, in this case, the notion that you couldn't raise your head at a certain moment in service, in the Jewish religious service, for fear that you would see God face to face and die. And so I start with just talking about a moment in which I lifted my eyes to try to see God face to face, accepting the idea that I would die. And I realized that it was a story.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't only a matter of disillusionment, though there was some disillusionment involved, but also a sense of just how powerful stories are that I, at that point, I was a little kid, but I was willing to stake my life on it.
Wow. You also write about how you try to imagine the story's beginning, because there's a scene in the book where you recall your mother in your Roxbury apartment.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
That's one of a number of examples of just trying to get back as far as we can. Look, the general principle of the story of Adam and Eve is that you have to bring yourself completely to it to understand it, because it's about you, the story. It's about where you came from and about your past.
Well, so to get back to Adam and Eve in particular, I mean, what do we know about the beginning of the beginning?
About the deep, deep beginning of the beginning, we know nothing.
Yeah.
That is to say, the story probably originated before the invention of writing, circulated in oral form that obviously doesn't leave a trace. We think that the story was first written down probably sometime in the form that we know it, sometime in the 6th century before the Common Era, but it probably had been written down already well before that. We just don't have traces of it. So it's
but
written
definitely
down
pre-Christian, for
it
sure.
It was certainly pre-Christian. Yeah. It was written down in the Hebrew world, probably at the moment that the Hebrews decided that they wanted to have a sacred book. And it was in the wake of almost a century of embittered exile in Babylon.
But of course, the Adam and Eve that everyone knows today is identified as, you know, one of the core biblical stories.
Yes.
Even though it's just such a small part of Genesis, right?
It's the beginning of the beginning. and it really, for the Jews and for Muslims, it isn't, how shall we say, the fulcrum story, the story in which everything depends. That would be the story of Abraham, and Isaac for the Jews, of Abraham and Ishmael for Muslims. But it was Christians, really, who made the decision of taking this story, which is told at the beginning of the book of Genesis, and using it as the rock on which to build their understanding of the Messiah who is, according to St. Paul, the new Adam. So if Jesus is the new Adam, it behooves you to know who the old Adam was.
Right. I mean, because you talk about a lost text, the life of Adam and Eve from the first century.
Not lost, but there are quite a few versions. People clearly felt very early that the story was parsimonious, that it didn't tell enough. They wanted to know what these people felt like when they started eating animal food, what it felt like when they ceased to be vegetarians, which they had been in Eden. When did they have their first argument? When did they first make love? And all of these details, which tantalized people, are not in the Bible, but were filled out quite early. And also, there are a number of texts that, obviously, many texts that have been lost, but among the most fascinating are a group of books that were recovered only in the 1940s when an Egyptian peasant digging for fertilizer came across a huge jar, broke open the jar and found, to his disappointment, that it contained not treasures, gold and silver, but books. But the books are ancient, and some of the books said, the hero of the story must have been the woman, must have been Eve, and not the god, because Eve chose to have knowledge against a irrational prohibition. Now, that interpretation was buried for 2,000 years for a reason, because it lost and was accordingly hidden. But it means that already 2,000 years ago, people, and probably before then, people realized that there's a twist or a paradox in the story. Because the Adam and Eve story is like a story written by Franz Kafka.
Yeah.
It has a kind of strange twist in it, which is that there's a prohibition, an absolute prohibition against eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But if you don't know the difference between good and evil, how can you reliably observe the prohibition? And people understood this, I think, very, very early.
The books that you were talking about, were some of those books that were found by that peasant, if I'm remembering correctly, included some like Gnostic Gospels? And
yes,
things like
in
that?
Fact, that's where the Gospel of
Thomas
comes from.
Now,
these are the so-called Nag Hammadi, because that's nearest town to the place that they were found.
That's right. And these were considered heretical when the Bible was assembled. Right?
And there are many. Heretical just means the position that lost.
Exactly.
There are many such things in the history of the story of Adam and Eve, including a very vigorous movement in the first century of the Common Era by early Christians just to scrap the whole thing, to get rid of it as ethically incoherent and intolerable. But that position lost.
Yeah.
And instead, the position that won was the position that was articulated most momentously by St. Augustine in the late 4th and 5th century, for whom the Adam and Eve story explained almost everything you needed to know, and particularly explained why we're the miserable wretches that we are. And that is the notion of original sin.
Yeah.
But Augustine connected the notion of original sin to the absolute injunction to take the story literally, to understand that this is not a myth like the story, how should we say, the story of Oedipus. This is the literal truth. These were our first parents. There was a real garden. There were real trees. There was a talking snake. And there was an act, a transgressive act that led to our current miseries.
So the concept of original sin doesn't actually exist in the story of Adam and Eve? That was something that Augustine brought to it?
Not a word of it. No notion of original sin any more than the notion of an apple. These are parts of the long history, to me, incredibly fascinating history of struggles on all sides as to what on earth this crucial story means. Does it, for example, say that women are fundamentally responsible for sin, are first and foremost responsible? Well, many people thought that is what it meant, that it was the origin of a long, bitter history of misogyny. But it isn't the only interpretation of the story by any means.
Right, because you write about how that that this concept of original sin isn't found in non-Christian readings of Adam and Eve.
No, Muslims don't have this notion, nor do Jews have the notion. They have, of course, a notion of sin, but not of a sexually transmitted original sin that passes to each generation before they make any choices.
It's so it's a difficult concept, because the built into this thinking, the Augustinian line of thinking, is if you are born with a disposition to do evil, but that disposition arises because Eve chose the fruit of knowledge. You know, so am I overreading this isn't it somewhat tragic that choosing rationality and knowledge then over the centuries becomes equated to this idea of original sin?
The first thing to say is you can't overread the story. or in any case, you wouldn't be able to, because if someone has already been there before, overreading it like crazy. And then it's the case that the tragic burden, which you've articulated, is, I think, it's not the only part of the story. There are dreams of the possibility of returning to Eden, as well as the burden of having been expelled from it. But yes, the notion that there's a catastrophe that happened, and it's a catastrophe that is profoundly difficult to understand, except as a tragic event. For example, the God who warns the humans in the garden that they must not eat of the tree tells the man that if he eats of the tree, he'll die. But he doesn't explain what death is. Mm. How, and again, people ask this question very, very early, how could the human possibly have understood the meaning of that warning in a world where there had been no death? That's, in effect, why the story has been so haunting. If it was simple, transparent, and immediately clear, I think it would have been chewed up, swallowed, and would have disappeared.
Mm-hmm. So we talked about Augustine for a little bit, but I just want to get your take on possibly one of the other major forces in terms of our popular understanding of Adam and Eve, and that's Milton, of course, and Paradise Lost.
So what you have to do, Magnus, that now we're jumping, of course,
a long
more
way
than a millennium, yeah, and it's worth thinking about what happens in that millennium. So Augustine basically issued a kind of charge to Christianity, which Christianity, because of his power, accepted, which is to take the story literally, to make it real. And there's an effort that takes – it's very difficult to make the story real, because the story of a naked man and woman talking snake and a magical garden with strange trees is not obviously and inherently real. So they asked themselves, because they were serious about this, this is a life and death matter, what would it mean to make it real? And we have an enormously long effort of this kind, asking lots of questions. How did the man name all the animals? How could he have done it? How could he have named the fish? Did they come to him? Did they come out of the water to do so? And so forth. I mean, you can't imagine the number of questions that were asked. Were fleas already invented then? There was a Renaissance saying, Adam had 'em, meaning already, yes, the fleas must have existed, and so forth. Milton comes at the end of this extraordinary process of trying to make the story literally true. And like the great painters of the Renaissance, Michelangelo or Albrecht Dürer and many, many others, Milton in poetry succeeds in actually bringing the figures to an apparent vivid life. In the case of Milton, they have a relationship. They have a marriage, it's like, which they had never really had before. They have a kind of marital squabble before the fall. And no one had succeeded in doing that to the hallucinatory degree that Milton did. But it comes at a cost, because it's created to make them real means that the whole story begins to groan under the pressure of all of the reality around them. Those Native Americans that after 1492 were found by the Europeans walking around apparently without bodily shame that they were supposed to have as a result of the fall of Adam and Eve, or the huge diversity of languages in the world, which began to worry people. How could Adam and Eve have begun to speak? And many, many questions that began to be asked. Milton was a deeply religious man. Many of the figures that we're talking about were profoundly religious, wanted to support the story, to fulfill this Augustinian inheritance. But the story begins to tilt, how shall we say, down the slope that leads to Darwin, to Mark Twain, to the figures in the 19th and then the 20th and 21st centuries who have made the literal belief in the story not impossible, because many, many people do continue to believe in the literal truth of the story, but make it difficult for mm-hmm. many people in our culture.
So on that note, what I hear and what's so compelling about your book is that because the story of Adam and Eve has it all, right? Innocence, temptation, sin, seduction, transgression, exile. Because it has it all, it feels like it's a story that's a really incredible Rorschach test for where we are as a people at any given time. So what do you think, or why do you think it's important for people to think about Adam and Eve and also think about how they think about this story today?
It's a very good question, Meghna, and I would start with saying simply that the story is one of the great works of the human imagination. I am not someone who can believe in the story literally as the actual way we originated. I have a different account of our origin, and I end my book with an account of chimpanzees in Western Uganda. But the story is a deep story about human responsibility. And to take just a single strand from the multiple strands of the story, we could start by thinking about the element of the story that says that something about the way in which the humans acted, something about the choice they made, led to a disastrous change in the earth. Now, that aspect of the story, that there's a relationship between the choices we make and the environment that we live in, I think for quite a long period of time, let's say from the time of Darwin until fairly recently, seemed like one of the most unreal, mythical parts of the story.
It doesn't seem
so much anymore.
Well, Stephen Greenblatt is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. He's a professor of the humanities at Harvard, and his latest book is The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve. It's been such a privilege to speak with you. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure for me, Meghna. Thank you.
Coming up, the special bond between a grandfather and granddaughter forged in the kitchen.
There is no better place after school to sit in the kitchen and do your homework. I mean, the smell there, the cling of the equipment, the voice of your mother, father, the taste, that stay with you the rest of your life.
When we're in the kitchen, we talk about so many different things. Like, I feel like when we're in the kitchen together, I get to know him so much better.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.